edition of The Autograph with me, Susan Lagares. We're coming to you from New York City. My guest this week is veteran journalist and author Thanasis Kambanis. He's joining us to talk about his book, A Privilege to Die. Do join us. Veteran Middle East correspondent Thanasis Kambanis has written about the Middle East since 2003 for the Boston Globe, the New York Times, and Global Post. He has reported in Iraq and the Middle East since 2003, serving as Baghdad and Middle East bureau chief for the Boston Globe for 4 years. He teaches at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs and the New School's graduate program in International Affairs. A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, is his first book. Kambanis follows a few Hezbollah families through the ups and downs of the 2006 war with Israel and the continuing preparations for another conflict, letting us listen in to Hezbollah members' intimate discussions at the kitchen table and on the battlefield. Kambanis' reporting puts a human face on the party of God, so we might understand the ideological and religious roots of today's conflict.
In the waning days of Israel's 2006 war with Lebanon, I was reporting from the front lines, trying to understand the motives of Hezbollah's fighters and loyalists. At the beginning of August, Israel warned that it would consider any car south of the Litani River a military target. I abandoned the free fire zone of South Lebanon for the relative safety of Beirut. At a slight remove from the rocket whistles and bomb thuds, Israeli bombardment still shook the Lebanese capital several times a day, the big questions raised by the conflagration came into focus. Israel and Hezbollah had fought many times before, but Hezbollah had now advanced a new idea whose destabilizing implications would persist long after this current conflict. Hezbollah had put back into popular currency a notion that had lain in tatters since 1967, that Arab forces could do more than terrorize or harass Israel, they could defeat and destroy it. I had spent 3 years in the Arab world, mostly based in Baghdad, covering the new politics that was emerging, especially as Shia parties began to take part in Iraqi politics. Everywhere I went as a journalist, the activists I talked to were constantly citing Hezbollah, the model for them of the kind of activism they wanted to do, the kinds of organizations they wanted to build, and the ideas that were really inspiring them. So I became more and more curious about really what Hezbollah was all about. We have a lot of misperceptions and sort of historical ideas about Hezbollah in the West that come from the 1980s when Hezbollah was taking American hostages and was being held responsible for the bombing of Marine barracks and the U.S. Embassy. But really, I had not much of a picture of what Hezbollah had become, and I was curious. So when war broke out in 2006 between Hezbollah and Israel, I immediately went to Lebanon, and my goal was to really learn as much as I could about not just about Hezbollah as a party, but as a popular movement, what the people inside Hezbollah believed and what they wanted. And it was that month or so that I spent under the bombs in Lebanon in Hezbollah villages that convinced me of the need for a book that would explain, mostly to an American audience, what made Hezbollah tick and what made its rank and file, its middle class volunteers so dedicated to the party of God.
And as you noted in the book, And we were having discussion before the interview started. Your book is not about the ideology of Hezbollah or about what policies they carry out or a handbook of let's learn about Hezbollah and it's so to say motivations on the paper. This is about people, a people's support of the group.
The main focus of my inquiry, my reporting was, Who supports Hezbollah? Why? What motivates them to join the party or volunteer for it or support it? And what do they want for their lives? Now, of course, in discussing this with people and really immersing myself in their lives, a lot of what they would talk about would be the ideology of Hezbollah or its political program or their view of their Shia faith and how they should translate it into action. So of course those ideas, those big ideas come into play, but what was interesting to me is that really alone among the Islamist movements that I covered, Hezbollah had a deeply rooted, enduring, and passionate popular following. In other words, they had hundreds of thousands of supporters who supported them with equal passion all the time. So not just at a moment of crisis, not just during a war or just during a political struggle, but day in, day out, during the boring weeks, during the long Sunday afternoons, they were turning again to Hezbollah as the sort of organizing principle of not just their politics, but their community life.
And why has Hezbollah turned into such a powerful force, not just in Lebanon and among the Muslim population, but I remember when we were in Lebanon, we would talk to Christians, and they would say that, you know, at the end of the day, we rely on Hezbollah. We support them 150% because some would say they're the ones that will defend us ultimately. Why the popularity?
Well, let's start with what is the core of Hezbollah's operating principles. I say at its root there are two things that make Hezbollah tick. One is a restoration of what I call a sort of Islamic prosperity gospel, a way of taking faith and asking people to apply it to every aspect of their lives, to improving themselves, improving their families, doing well, and being properly, responsibly, pious. The other part is perpetual war against Israel. And that, of course, is a very popular and unifying cause, not just in Lebanon, but throughout the Arab world, and maybe even the wider Islamic world. But Hezbollah has successfully fused these two principles, and that has made them somewhat surprisingly appealing far beyond their natural constituency. And this is a Shia Islamist movement. They call themselves the Islamic Resistance. Yet their biggest supporter inside Lebanon is a secular Christian party. Even more surprising, you go outside of Lebanon, Sunni Arabs in Egypt regularly rank Hassan Nasrallah as the most popular leader in the world. Turks, who are neither Arab nor Shia, have a similar rosy view of Nasrallah. Why is this? In my view, partly it's because of a complete failure of Arab politics. I mean, there is no successful politics elsewhere in the Arab world. So if you oppose Israel's policies, or if you oppose America's treatment of the Middle East, and you're looking for a movement, there aren't really any successful alternatives out there other than Hezbollah. Any movements that have really successfully challenged Israel or the United States. And secondly, they're very popular because they've been successful. I mean, this is people like movements whose ideas work, and for the time being, I mean, Israel has actually been put on the defensive by Hezbollah in a way that no other movement in the Arab world has done. Hezbollah ended the Israeli occupation of South Lebanon in 2000. It's widely viewed as having won the 2006 war. So I think that explains a lot why secular people, Christian people, even atheists I know and communists I know will cast their lot with the Islamic Resistance, even though they have very little interest in the Islamic part of it, but they really are wedded to the Resistance.
After the 2006 war with Israel, some believe that Hezbollah moved from strength to strength despite being labeled as a terrorist organization by Israel and sometimes the United States. Do you think that the United States and Israel are thinking, where did we go wrong?
I think the United States and Israel are struggling to come to terms with the fact that Hezbollah is not going to change its ideology and cannot be erased by force. I mean, the operating principle for the coalition of the Western coalition that includes primarily Israel and the United States has been to push for the end of Hezbollah and the end of an Islamic resistance movement in Lebanon. That's simply not possible. I mean, it's a deeply rooted mass movement with maybe a million sympathizers and followers. It cannot simply be removed. If Hezbollah is gonna stop fighting, it's gonna be because of some kind of political process or political solution. And I'm not sure that realization has yet set in to Western and Israeli policymakers. Their view of Hezbollah really hasn't evolved as Hezbollah has evolved. I mean, as I noted earlier, 30 years ago, Hezbollah's main military tactics were suicide bombings against soft targets, including embassies. Now their tactics are standard guerrilla warfare tactics against, for the most part, military targets, and again, not completely, but for the most part, they follow the norms and laws of warfare that Western armies follow as well, with the exception of indiscriminate targeting of civilian areas during times of war, which comes in the context of Israel doing the same to Lebanon. So they've really changed. Now, that doesn't mean that America's going to like them. It doesn't mean Israel is going to accept them. But it's impossible to point a finger at Hezbollah and say they're the same organization that blew up the Marine barracks 3 decades ago. And whatever policy the West comes up with is going to have to take into account those million followers and sympathizers. I mean, that's why they're the subject of my book, because let's say one day Hassan Nasrallah is gone, let's say one day Hezbollah changes its platform or policy, those million people have been deeply inculcated into a set of beliefs and practices, and they will still be right there living in Lebanon no matter what happens at the top of Hezbollah.
In your book, you talk about the Hezbollah soccer moms and a fellow that moved all the way from Manhattan back to Lebanon because he wanted to raise his kids in an environment that is Hezbollah supported, so to say, because he believed that it was morally right and it was the safe place to be. Can you tell us a little more about the characters that we read about in your book, the foot soldiers of Hezbollah, that are not necessarily armed men and women with guns running around?
And they're not necessarily members of the party. Uh-huh. They're supporters who believe in Hezbollah's program and ideology, and they do so without even rising to the level of joining, getting official membership, or working for the party. And this is a key source of its strength. The man you mentioned, Faraz Jamal, I talk about him a lot just because he's so indicative of the attraction Hezbollah has for middle-class, educated, prosperous people. This guy lived in Manhattan, as you said, was making, I think, pretty good money, had kids, and in his view, Aitashab on the border of Israel was a safer place to raise his kids than New York City. And of course, that seems odd to the Western ear, because this was at a time when Israel was still occupying South Lebanon, so it was a daily war zone. It wasn't a place where every now and again there'd be a war. It was a place where every week people were getting killed. And he up and took his kids, moved back there, built a new house, started a business, and there are thousands of people like him. I mean, he's not an aberrant character. You know, just for my book, there were half a dozen people I spoke to who had a similar trajectory, and these were people who would come to Lebanon on vacation, meet their relatives in Hezbollah, and say, "Huh, I think I would rather live here, despite poverty, despite the instability, despite the likelihood that life will be punctuated by destructive mm-hmm. wars, they chose this because they believed in the values of what Hezbollah calls the Society of Islamic Resistance, which is a really all-encompassing, it's an all-encompassing framework for your life. It's not just a war against Israel and a particular credo of belief. It's the scout troop you send your kids to on Sunday and to summer camp in the summers. It's the women's group that meets and studies religion together and then does fundraising projects for charity. It's the health clinics. It's it's the schools. It's the psychological services that Hezbollah sends out to counsel its members when they're suffering from depression. This is a finely wrought web of services and beliefs that in the end creates very deep loyalty.
Part standing army, part political party, and part theological movement, the author writes Hezbollah is made up not just of unemployed young men, but also middle-class engineers, merchants, even nurses. Hezbollah's widespread popularity rests on its ability to offer its followers economic reform, affordable health care, dependable electricity, efficient courts, and safe streets, as well as victory over Israel. Unique to the party is its powerful doctrine of self-improvement, which challenges its members to fight ignorance and make money. What are some of the misconceptions about Hezbollah in the West? Is it the diversity of this group that we seldom understand?
Well, in my view, the biggest misconception about Hezbollah goes before what you mentioned. It's something much more basic, which is Westerners have a lot of trouble understanding this idea of martyrdom and willingness to die as something that exists in people who are not bloodthirsty, murderous fanatics. And this is sort of the peak of the Western misunderstanding. How is Hezbollah different than Al Qaeda, right? I mean, this is a question I get all the time, mm-hmm. and then people point to the title of my book, "Privilege to Die." It's a quote from a man who says to me in the middle of the war, "It would be a privilege to die for Syed Hassan Nasrallah." And to a Westerner, they don't understand how that can be a constructive belief for this man as opposed to a destructive one, and they think of Hezbollah as being hordes of people who hate life, hate modernity, and just want to die. They want to do anything they can to destroy Israel, and they're willing to die to do that. I try to show just through their lives, through the way they fight and the way they live when they're not fighting, that it's much more akin to the way Americans view patriotism. I mean, the loyalty and willingness to die of Hezbollah's not just fighters but rank and file memberships is partly rooted in the fact they don't expect to die. They don't want to die, but they are willing to die and consider it a privilege and honor if they are to die for their cause. And that's much more enduring than the kind of death cult that you will see among Salafist supporters of Al Qaeda. I mean, some of those foot soldiers seem truly to prefer the idea of being dead to the idea of being alive. Mm-hmm. That has nothing to do with Hezbollah's ideology, and this is something that it's been a source of strength for Hezbollah. The fact that its followers are willing to lose their lives or their homes or their livelihoods in as part of their effort, and they do this because they love their lives. They love their lives and they love their ideas, so they're willing to lay down their lives to protect that set of ideas. And that kind of motivation, it's rooted in religion and it's rooted in community, and it's, I think, very foreign for Americans in particular to understand. Because Americans, when they talk about being willing to die for their country, use a secular rhetoric, right? They talk about dying for America, dying for their nation. They don't talk about dying for God. Although many American soldiers are deeply religious and are motivated by their faith as well. So when the American ear hears someone talking about Imam Ali or the Battle of Karbala as part of why they're willing to risk their lives, they see that as fanaticism rather than as a form of perhaps militant, but militant patriotism and communal loyalty. And that is misunderstood very deeply.
Very, very interesting, and a great analysis on that. What is the future of Hezbollah, in your view?
I think Hezbollah is going to be a sort of inescapable part of Lebanese and Arab politics for some time to come. I mean, in my view, Hezbollah has been the most articulate and dynamic alternative to the Arab regimes. Hezbollah is, I would say, the brain trust of this idea of an axis of resistance, right? This idea of resistance as a unifying force opposing, you know, Western hegemony or Western influence. It's a radical idea. I mean, some of the regimes that support Hezbollah, in a way, could be threatened by Hezbollah's calls for transparency and accountability and popular service. I mean, it's interesting to see that Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, and Hamas are all in a coordinated axis when those four groups have a lot of differences in the way they govern their own followers. Hezbollah is going to be a big part of the story no matter what happens. Things could change, though, in serious ways in the future. Right now, Hezbollah is facing the specter of sectarianism. I mean, they are a Shia party that has positioned themselves as a unifying, non-sectarian force.
Yeah.
But lots of Sunnis and lots of Christians in Lebanon still see them as a fundamentalist, even fanatical Shia Islamist party, and Hezbollah has taken some sectarian moves, including the fighting in the streets of Beirut in 2008, which even Ayatollah Fadlallah warned was a mistake that was casting Hezbollah as a Shia party rather than as a national unifying party.
Mm-hmm.
So they face risks. In that sense, they also face risks as geopolitics changes. I mean, the Hezbollah counts a lot on their alliances with Syria and Iran, and Syria and Iran have other interests as well. So it's possible that one day either or both of those governments, not that they would reject Hezbollah necessarily, but that they would all hold it in a less close embrace, give it less support, and that would make Hezbollah weaker as a militia or as a regional player. And I think that is one of the things that Hezbollah has been planning for. They've been trying to increase their independent sources of funding. They've been trying to increase their ability to function and survive if their partners are forced to create some distance.
That's all the time we have for this edition of The Autograph here on Press TV. Thank you for staying with us and watching. Remember, you can always send us your emails, questions, and comments to The Autograph at SusanMadires.com. We're always looking forward to them. Until next week and another show from all of us here in New York City, goodbye.